great pleasure in a proper radio studio to meet Numi.
Hi.
Now, we are at KMFM. Of course, we met at KMTV.
Yes.
We were trying to work out. We think it was in June.
Yeah.
And that was for the film programme.
Yes. Yeah.
And now I'm going to find out other parts of your life story, because I know about your favourite films. I know about Walter Mitty.
Yes.
But now I've got to find out how the journey started for you. I'll say from the outset, Numi, that when I learned that you have this fascinating... I mean, there must be nobody else in the world who has a robotics engineering background and now does a daily drive show on Kent Radio. And I want to sort of tease out the journey and all the bits in between.
Yeah. I think I'm probably the only one. And maybe I need to have that claim somewhere. But if there's anyone else out there, would love to meet you.
Well, I know a friend. His name is Martin Bloomfield. And he went on this search for anybody else with the same name. And he found one. And in the UK, not that far away. So they're now like really good friends.
Wow.
And the only thing they share is the name.
Yeah.
And the fact that they're both in the UK. And so it's that sort of sense that sometimes if somebody has followed the same story, are they going to be completely similar to you? Or do you sort of think, I would never be friends with this person if I met them?
Yeah,
interesting, these worlds kind of collide.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So how did it all start for you? Because was radio something that you always knew you wanted to do, or did you fall into it?
Yeah, I think I kind of fell into it. I always loved consuming radio. So I remember as a kid listening to our local commercial station was Silk FM, because I grew up in Macclesfield. And I remember the jingles. Me and my sister used to like sing along all the jingles. And I then started listening to BBC Radio 1. So I used to get up, get ready to school, listening to Chris Moyles. And I loved his radio style, his presentation. He was so funny, the creativity. And I don't think, you know... I'm kind of sad that I listened to him when I was like 9, because now being in the craft, I think I would appreciate it so much more. But before, I enjoyed it passively. I didn't know what kind of was going on, but I knew that it was a good product that I was enjoying. But I wasn't one of those kids that was like, I'm going to be a radio presenter. I just kind of enjoyed it.
Yeah, but you said something really interesting there about listening passively, because I could tell you the same story, admittedly, showing that obviously it's quite a big age difference between us, because I also listened to Radio 1 growing up, but it was Mike Read, and it was Mike Smith and Simon Mayo. But when I was growing up, I'd listen to them, but now that I do radio as well, obviously not on the same level that you are, it's almost like I'm imbibing the sort of the, and even people have said, I think, that the way I present a program is very much in the spirit of that kind of era.
So
maybe actually that kind of, like driving a car, isn't it? That until you actually sit behind the wheel, you don't, even if you've been a passenger for years, so you've been there passively in the car, you don't actually know what sort of driver you're going to be. And when you do it, you think, this feels like me. It's sort of people have different ways of driving. But until you actually do it, you don't know quite what you're sort of imbibing.
Or what's going to subconsciously influence you later on. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I didn't really think about radio that much. I used to love drama at school, so I think I always had that kind of flair for performance. But I have very wonderful, very pragmatic parents who worked really hard to build careers in the corporate world. So my dad was in banking, my mum was in pharmaceuticals. Very strong, successful, wonderful people. So having them as role models has been fabulous. But they were also, when I was like, I think I want to do acting, they were like, oh, it's a bit, unstable. It's a bit competitive. What about other careers that are perhaps, more likely to give you a steady paycheck? So it wasn't like they never like shut me down, but they kind of gave me critical thoughts of what is realistic, So I also like loved, I was a nerd in school, so I enjoyed science, I loved maths and everything. And then when I was 13, I also loved everything Japanese, because my mum used to go and my dad used to go on business trips a lot to Japan, and they would bring back stickers and Hello Kitty toys and everything. Every time they'd come back, it was like Christmas. They'd be like, look what we found on this trip. And me and my sister were really into Japanese culture, and we were really into anime and manga, Japanese comic books. And we read this comic book called Chobits that had humanoid robots in, called Personacoms. And I read this manga and I was like, oh, these are really cool. It would be really cool if your job was to build robots like this. So I basically went to my physics teacher and said, if I want to build robots as a job, what do I have to do? And he was like, well, if you want to physically build them, you should probably do D&T. And I was like, well, I've dropped that. So next up. And he's like, well, if you wanted to build, you know, the kind of software behind them, the brains of the robots, you'll want to do physics and maths for GCSE, do them for A-levels, and then do electronic and electrical engineering at university. And I said, okay. And then I did that.
Now, two things there. Because, like you, the most amazing supportive parents, but who also thought when I was young, I think that this sort of word, I want to be a DJ, and they were like, you know, how does that happen? Because unless you've got somebody in your family or you know somebody who knows somebody, then I guess to sort of make that sort of leap, I might as well have said, I want to walk on the moon.
Yeah.
So it seemed that sort of far away from the world in which I was living. The funny thing now is all these years later, I do a live show on Tuesday afternoons, and my parents listen.
Yeah.
So it's almost like, see?
Because I went
off and did very good, respectable stuff. And I don't regret anything I've done, except I always knew that there was this other world that I wasn't a part of, but kind of needed to be. And it was sort of always following me around, or I was chasing it.
Yeah.
And you never know. It's like, it's the elusive dream. And we probably will get onto Walter Mitty on this. You know, do you actually ever get to live out those fantasies? Or maybe you want to keep them in a box and you maybe occasionally, maybe like later of an evening with a glass of wine or something. You peek in and you say, oh, let me look into this. But then the next morning you get on with your the real world, with the day job.
Yeah.
But it sounds like you very successfully managed to not even bridge those two worlds, because those two worlds don't need to be bridged. It's the fact that we all have different facets of our personality. We do, you know, we're not always the same person. You know, by day you could be working in an office, by night you could be playing in an orchestra or playing football or something. You know, the two don't have to be the same. But it sounds like for you, you managed to make that transition.
Yeah, so I followed my instructions very diligently, and I... there was, you know, obviously with life, you have different changes. So, for example, I moved to Switzerland with my parents. My mum got a job there. So I didn't do A-levels. I did the IB and ended up at York studying electronic engineering. And it's this kind of invisible string thing of you kind of trace back how your life has played out, and that interesting thing of, wow, if this never happened, then I never would have been here. Because I didn't do very well in my IB, and I got into York through clearing. and that, I think that was a very formative experience for me, because I had never failed before, because I'd come from such a lovely, supportive family that had encouraged hard work. You know, I had that classic, when you're younger, natural talent that kind of gets you by enough that if you do a bit of work, you're okay. And, you know, privileged background to enable that. So this was kind of my first taste of failure. And I was like, well, I'm not doing this again. I was like, I'm going to work so hard that I can never fail again.
Do you know, I think that everybody needs that, because I remember being at school and there were always people who were, I mean, we didn't have A stars in those days because I was only the second year of GCSEs, but the equivalent. In other words, without seemingly effortlessly, they were just going to get the best grades ever. And I was always in their shadow. Many years later, met some of them again, and suddenly you think, well, you dropped out of university, you're not the same person. Of course, they have personal reasons for it.
Yeah, and
you then see the whole life story unfolding before you. And on the other hand, I think I'm somebody who sort of did all the things I was supposed to do, followed, you know, played by the rules, all very wonderful. But there comes a point later on when you think, hang on a minute, great, I've done all the right things, but all the people around you have kind of moved on. And there's a point when you think, hang on, I'm the one who didn't necessarily want this life, this career, this job, and yet I'm the one who's done it longer than anybody else,
yeah,
who perhaps did crave for that. So suddenly you think, hang on a minute, maybe I'm allowed to think outside of the box.
Yeah. So I went to York, loved York, was doing electronic engineering, and in my second year, I was in the labs, and this guy who was like a couple of years older than me, I'd seen him around, but we'd never really spoken that much before, needed something out of the desk that I was sat at. So he was like, can I get something, blah, blah, blah. And we were just chatting, and then he goes, have you ever considered doing student radio? Because I used to be very loud in labs and quite annoying. And I think he'd obviously heard me but like the previous term. And he was like, have you ever considered doing student radio? Because you've got the voice for it. I was quite impressed by this man. And so I was like, oh, I will do anything that you say to try and impress you. So literally, because a cute boy said, have you thought about doing radio? It is now my career. Which, looking back, you're like, that's kind of embarrassing.
but do you think that if that conversation hadn't happened, that, you know, okay, somebody else would have said it on a different day. It's a bit like some of those like sliding doors things.
Yeah.
But it would have happened anyway. In other words, rather than you have no plan to do radio, but suddenly somebody says you do it and then you do it, do you think that it was ingrained in you? By the sound of it, from what you were saying about growing up with the radio, it was. So you may not have done student radio, but do you sort of, from where you are now, look back and think, this feels like it was the right thing? Because otherwise it's somebody else's dream. If somebody says, oh, you should do radio, but it might be what they think you should do rather than what you do. Mm. But obviously you've taken to this very well.
Yeah, so I hope that would be true, because yeah, I was like, okay, I'm going to do it. And literally, I think the first time I was on air, it was a candidate interview night for the student union election. So everyone gets involved in the station and lots of people interview. So my first bit of radio was a 5-minute interview for the women's officers. There was only one candidate, you can run as two. There were two people running and they were unopposed. So it was like, this is the easiest interview you'll ever have to do, because as long as you don't say anything horrendous, people are going to vote for you, because it's better than having to go through the faff of reopening nominations. So I was literally on air for 5 minutes. Everyone else was doing everything around me. I wasn't driving the desk or anything. I was just sat there asking these questions to these two people, and hearing my voice in my headphones, the environment of the studio, knowing that there's just this magic of being live where there's this nervousness to it, because you're like, oh, if it goes wrong, it could really go wrong and we can't undo it. We can't control Z because it's going out there. And this excitement that you are in the moment is just magical and unparalleled. And as soon as I had that feeling, I was like, I have to do this again.
Yeah, and a parallel story there, because I've only been doing it for 15 weeks, but I only do live radio. In other words, no one is making me do it live. I can pre-record, but why would I want to do that?
Yeah.
When I used to teach students, you know, obviously they were live events,
in the sense that
you've got students in front of you. If somebody had said, oh, don't worry about, you know, don't do your 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, I'll just do it on Zoom, you know, pre-record it like we had to do during lockdown. But rather than think, oh, that saves me a bit of time, I'd think, why would I want to do that?
Yeah.
The whole point of doing it is that whether the audience is there or not, whether you see them or not, you know that there is something interactive going on, and you make it interactive.
Yes.
Pre-record it, that can never happen.
Yes. And I think there's, because I've had to pre-record stuff before throughout my career, you know, stuff that goes out over Christmas, numerous things, there's just something different when you know you. I think there's something different in your delivery. When you know that you can make a mistake, that you can take your time, that you can do it again. I think that affects how you present. Whereas when you know that you can't mess up, it gives you that extra edge that just can't be replicated.
Do you know, because the first thing I said to you before we started this interview was, obviously, I'll edit it. Now, this is interesting. I always said that as a way of reassurance to people. But when I do live radio, obviously, I have guests in the studio, I can't say to them, oh, don't worry, you know, I'll edit it.
Yeah.
And now I listen back to the interviews that I do, and I haven't actually done any editing for the recent ones because I'm so used to the free-flowing sort of conversation. Yeah. Sometimes if there are lots of ums and ahs, then sometimes, yes, it might be appropriate to take some of those out. But actually, what's the point? Because the whole point is that it's a real... It feels like being on a bus.
Yeah.
Somebody wants to use that analogy. You're sitting on a bus, you overhear somebody's conversation and your stop is coming up, but you think, I'll just stay on for an extra stop or maybe two stops because I want to see how this unfolds. And that's something that you'd never have replicated if it's all done in a sort of a way that's just a little bit too pristine.
Yeah, I do think there is obviously advantages to editing in commercial radio. We pre-record stuff because on a station like KMFM, if you had a caller come on and they effed and blinded, then that would be a problem. So there are elements where you do have to pre-record things like interviews as well. With a commercial music station, you wouldn't have like a 15-minute free-flowing interview. So I do think there are, you know, there is space for that sometimes. And then it is the challenge of getting that feeling where it feels like a natural conversation, but it's tighter than just, you know, a long form thing. And that is a skill that, you know, is why there is a huge industry of producers and podcast editors, because the credit to those people, it is a skill on how to do that.
Yeah, and the question I'm about to ask might sound odd, but it's not whether you've renounced what you did before, but it's more like, do you kind of feel that you're on the right track? Not that you were on the wrong track when you were, you know, doing all your robotics engineering work, but is there a sort of a sense in which that is something that is hovering, it's there, you tap into it, it coexists with what you're doing now? Do you kind of feel that everything's in the right sort of balance? Because, and I ask that because I'm asking myself that same question. When you wear multiple hats, and, you know, my students see me in one way, my family see me in another, people who I get coffee from or people at the cinema see me in a different capacity. And in a way, they all work together, but people just see one side. So do you kind of feel that, you know, you are where you need to be for as long as you need to be there?
Yes, I think So I did a PhD in robotics and I finished it during COVID. So there was obviously elements in there. But I found my PhD experience quite traumatic. I found it really hard. I really struggled with working by myself. I really struggled with like working towards a goal that's 4 years away. What I love about radio is my deadline is every day. You know, I can't procrastinate for the whole day because otherwise when the mic goes up at four, I'm going to get fired because I've got nothing to say. You know, like I have to prepare, plan, deliver. Whereas my PhD, I was the queen of procrastination until it was like 3 months before the deadline. It's like, oh, great, I've got to do a year's worth of work in 4 weeks. Here we go. So it was a very difficult process for me. I don't regret doing it. I think it was, it's like when people train for marathons and do marathons. You might look at that and go, why the hell would you put your body through that? But people like, you know, I think it is good to know that you have the strength to do something that difficult. I will never do something that difficult again. And I will not be running a marathon.
Nah. But there is something there, isn't there, though, about how when you're, you know, if you're committed to something, you want to see it through. Maybe the mistake I've made in the past is to think, oh, I've done that. Like I did the PhD. Great. But then it's like, what do I do now? Oh, I'll do another book on the same topic as the PhD. In other words, it's almost like I've achieved that. I'm a specialist. Therefore, the next thing I do has to be a continuation of that, but on the same trajectory. And in a way, you know, when you think that when you're at school, the number of years between GCSE, A-level, and then a university degree is only, what, 5-6 years?
Yeah.
I did my GCSE summer 89. In 1994, I got my degree. 5 years after that, I'd already had a master's and then did my PhD, finished my PhD. So you think, you know, in the space of 10 years, all those things happened. But in the 10 years after that, you know, it was almost a case of, I'm just doing another variation on the thing that I did in 1999.
And
I think what you've highlighted is actually really important because, you know, if I'm teaching my students, then I might sometimes think, oh, you know, I need to write that book and I need to be in an office and shut myself away and do it. But when I'm in my office shutting myself away, of course I'm thinking, I actually miss teaching the students, so I need to be around people.
Yeah.
So actually these things are not actually binaries. At any one moment, you might need to be in one space, not the other. But once you've, you know, you can do your radio show for a few hours in the evening, but then once that's done, you go to another space and do something else that's completely different.
Yeah.
And you can do and repeat it the next day.
Yeah, so I think I needed a little bit of a break because I'd really burnt myself out. And obviously, during that time, I had then, you know, got the dream. I was now full-time on radio. So it was like, well, I don't need this anymore. Like, I'm never going to need a PhD in robotics doing music radio. Bye. But it is obviously, like you say, it's a facet of my personality. It's been part of me since I was 13. And I am passionate about it. I love technology. And particularly, I've always been really passionate about outreach and encouraging young girls and women into STEM. So it's really been this year, and I've always said there will be a way that I will incorporate that side into me now being in media. I was like, I don't know what it is yet, but it will happen. I used to joke as well, it's like, if they need a new host for Robot Wars, then that'll be it. But I've just literally, we put our first episode out last week. A friend from uni, we did our undergrad together. We've started a podcast called Tech Girl Energy. So we have a weekly podcast where we just talk about the week's tech news. And then we've got another kind of spin-off that will launch soon that's longer form that is focusing on different people, mainly women in engineering, in technology, and what they do. But the crux is, it isn't like, how did I become a woman in engineering and how did I overcome the boundaries? Because a lot of those podcasts exist and that is an important conversation. But what we want to do is highlight all the cool jobs that you can have in engineering and technology that you might not know when you're at school and you're learning Pythagoras theorem. So, you know, do you want to make something that is in the phone of millions of people around the world? Well, that's app development. Do you want to make Ariana Grande's song sound fantastic? That's audio engineering. Do you want to save people's lives? That's medical engineering. And really showing that those applications being very application focused and having a conversation like we are now with the people doing it and showing as well that they're not just in a hoodie and jeans, tapping away on a laptop in a dark room. They might be there with a Fendi bag and acrylic nails and they've just had their hair done and they, you know, they might not look like what you think an engineer is, and an engineer doesn't have to be that way. You can be a girly girl or you can be a tomboy or you can be somewhere in between. And really showing that as a possibility.
That is amazingly inspiring because you've just made me think of how, certainly when I was growing up, it was almost like, well, these are the options. And you'd almost sort of like feel that, imagine like when I became a lecturer, I was emulating the lecturers before me.
Yes.
In other words, I dress like them. I don't do that now. And I'm starting to suddenly realise.
Yes, I saw the leather jacket.
Well, do you know, this is the funny thing, actually, because there was a time when you'd think, oh, my lecturers, I saw my professor in the supermarket. What's he doing there? He does his own shopping. You know, you're thinking that doesn't make any sense. Because these days, a student, well, I don't get the sense that my students thought it was in any way odd that there I am on Facebook every day in a different cinema in front of a different film poster.
Yeah.
And, you know, but of course that was also my work because,
yeah,
although I made it my work. Now that's the thing, because 20, 30 years ago, I thought, well, you know, I'm a theologian or that was what I was aiming towards and that was it. So you might have similar interests, but you wouldn't, the idea that you could make a career out of doing something different, you're either one thing or another. And I think I realised one day someone said, how would you define yourself? Almost like, what is your eulogy, you know, your epitaph? Mm. And suddenly the thought of Chris D.C., lecturer or theologian, thought, well, yeah, that's technically my job, but that is such a small part of who I know I am. And if that's the case, well, I need then to almost like say to the world, there is,
there's this other side of me.
Yeah, because if I'm in denial almost of, you know, or I'm just propagating one particular way of doing things. So what you said, and how inspiring as well, that particularly young women who might not, certainly in my generation, would have thought that there were options, you know, going down a science route in the way that you have, and actually then actually do a job that you want to do rather than just do something that, you know, effectively a woman in a man's world.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, we're in such an exciting period of development where technology is literally in anything. So any of your interests, there's probably an engineering or tech role that's related to it. You know, even if you really like food, we've got smart fridges now. You could build them. Like, it's crazy. But I think when you're in a school environment, you don't get to see that. And it's the classic thing of, oh, well, when am I going to use this in real life? Like, when am I going to use Pythagoras' theorem and everything? And I really want to, I don't know how we're going to do it yet, but I really want to get to the point where it's like, well, this person, my PhD was basically entirely Newton's second law. It was F equals MA, and that was it. And now I'm a doctor, you know? So it's like, I want to make those connections for people so that they can see themselves in that space. Because I think it is difficult. A lot of these programs are very general, which I think is good because your interests can change over time as well. But you might not be in a classroom thinking, oh, I want to do engineering. But you might be there going, I love using filters on my phone and they're really cool. And I don't really know how they work, but they make my pictures look nice. Or like, I love doing a silly TikTok with a filter on. And you could make those, you know, people design those. There is a career for you to do that if that's your interest.
Yeah, because education, I think, used to be much more in the vein of you sit still in class and you listen to what the teacher tells you, you pay attention and you write it down, you regurgitate it. And if you don't, you get into trouble, you get detention or you're told off or humiliated, you know, stand in front of the class because you've, you know. Whereas these days you might think, well, that person might have ADHD, they might have autism, they might have anything which actually could be impairing their ability to learn, but actually they are perfectly capable. They just need to be put into the right, or given the nurtured in the right way, put into the right kind of, you know, supporting environment. And so nowadays, I think that education has changed.
Yes,
because it's not, you know, the way that I teach. You know, in a way, actually, the transition from teaching to radio is an effortless one for me, in the sense that it's the interaction. You're engaging with the people in the room. You're thinking on the spot. You're talking about something in the news, something that you can relate to the students. Mm. Whereas in the old days, you'd have somebody saying, "This is the answer to the question." Even now, I remember. Is it 3.1415927? That's the only thing I know about pi, but it's ingrained in me. But it means nothing to me other than the fact that I know what it is. But that was education; it was drilled into me.
Yeah.
I can tell you what pi is. What does it mean? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it's the ratio between.
I said I would edit. No.
The diameter of a circle. Exactly. I do think teaching has changed a lot in university, because I taught at university for a brief time as well. There was a lot of development there, because if you think about, like, I remember when I first started uni, I had lecturers who would have their notes on a projector roll and just deliver it, whereas now there's a lot of research into pedagogy, and there's problem-based learning is huge now in universities, where it's like you are doing work, you are applying that information, that theory immediately to learn how to apply it, rather than like, here's this information and then there's some questions and you can see how it works out later. Like, it's very much an interactive and engaged process. And I think that that's really important, because the amount, you know, the actually, if you think about the percentage of people that can receive information that way, of being sat in a lecture, being just spoken at and understand is difficult. I don't think it really worked for me. I just happened to make friends with some really smart people, and then we would study together and I'd be like, I don't get this at all. And then they would show me and I'd be like, okay, I get it now.
It's funny, isn't it? Because even in films, and even because they're showing all the old Spider-Man films, and maybe that's the one I'm thinking of because I saw it just the other night, and it's somebody being in a lecture room and they're with 100 other people, and the lecturer is doing exactly what you said there, or they're using paper, they're reading it out. But then there might be a spin on that. I remember Barbara Streisand's The Mirror Has Two Faces, when she's doing this lecture, and it's on love. She's an English professor. But of course, what's hilarious is that she knows the names of all the people in the room, and that there are so many of them. And so they're saying something, and she's sort of relating it to her experience. And I thought that was kind of funny, because it was almost like the transition between the two worlds. She's standing there and delivering, but then almost like suddenly, because she's not in love and she's talking about romantic love, and because she hasn't experienced it in her life, she's sort of getting all this inspiration from the students and her. And suddenly it's like suddenly her personal life is, finding its, its catharsis through this lecture on that subject. And it's kind of hilarious because, I was sort of thinking, if only my lectures could be like that. But in a way, maybe not on that subject.
That transformative.
But they are. but not on that subject necessarily. So there are these very curious things, but also it's like I'd watch those films and think, yeah, actually, why can't it be like that? The fact that it wasn't then, I don't think I ever had a seminar when I was at university, because lectures, I mean, lectures sometimes had an element of asking questions. There was an interactive element, but we didn't really call them seminars. There were a few, but these days sometimes people say, oh, we don't really have lectures for our course. They're just sort of like lecture seminars.
Yeah,
but the seminar bit is the bit that kind of overrules the lecture component.
Yeah, yeah. When I was, so I taught foundation year maths and physics for a year during my PhD, and I took it on from someone else, so I didn't have to create any of my own material, which is great because that's so much work. Just had to deliver what was already written. But the way that was structured, I think, worked really well, where you'd kind of explain a bit of theory and then we would immediately do some questions. So it was, a little bit of me going, this is how you factorise a quadratic equation. And then it was like, right, we're going to do it together immediately. So it meant that they were engaged. You could get that interactivity with the students and they were immediately applying that knowledge. Because it's if you're just, sat there for an hour where there's no engagement, you're going to go on your phone, you're going to have a nap, you're going to book train tickets for your trip home at the weekend. But if there's that, if you're constantly having to do something, and that loop as well of, it's important for forming those pathways in your brain to remember this information, to actually, do the work and understand it rather than just reading or listening.
Yeah, and as you're talking there, it just made me think that whereas just a few decades ago, you'd be told, even at university sometimes, don't bring your phones into the lecture room. The idea being that, and certainly in schools, because it would be a distraction, because, people would be abusing it. They'd go on, even not that we necessarily had social media in the same way 20 years ago, but the idea is that you'd be using it to text or you'd be messing around. But these days, of course, you need one because you can't do your class. In some cases, you actually physically can't do the class because you need to, for example, scan a code to show that you actually attended. So if you haven't got your phone, actually you're disadvantaged. So again, if the same educator 20 years ago had a glimpse into the future, they probably wouldn't recognise, because it all happens incrementally, although the way that we all suddenly started using Zoom during lockdown showed how quickly technology can move on.
Yeah.
But it shows that actually technology is driving education.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a really good example of, I think for everybody, regardless of the industry that you are in, the amount of the rapid uptake and learning curve that everyone had to go through to use new technological tools was really steep. I think I was at an advantage because I'm quite tech savvy. It's not even just doing engineering, like being a young person, I like the internet and my phone and technological devices. But some of my co-workers at the university, the head of foundation year didn't really use video calls at all much before, so I had to teach her how to use Zoom. We set up a Slack for students to ask for questions and help, so I had to write like support documents for students as well on how to use these platforms, and everyone had to become experts overnight. I think as well one of the things a lot of people had to do was learn how to, you know, fix things themselves, because before, if your laptop didn't work, then you'd go to IT and they'd fix it for you. But if you're at home and you can't talk to anybody, you have to learn how to join a Zoom call, check that your microphone's working, make sure that you're not on mute, make sure your video's working. And I think that gave a lot of people digital skills.
Yeah. Are you in touch with any of your old teachers, either at school or university?
So I'm still friends with some people from university. Helen, who was my colleague from Foundation Year, we catch up a lot. My main PhD supervisor as well, we still talk. From high school, though, not really, although a very weird connection of life, because my family are now back in Cheshire, where I went to school. My sister's friend now teaches at my old school, and my parents went to her wedding and were sat next to my German teacher. So my parents sent me a picture of, like, partying with Frau Morris. And she was, it was kind of weird because she obviously felt like, I think that distance between a teacher and a student in high school is obviously a lot bigger than with lecturers. So she felt like such an adult when I was 15, but she must have only been in her early 20s. And she was so stern. So then to see her a bit bevved, yeah, with my mum was like, and also like, wow, I think you're actually only in your late 30s now. Yeah. You were way younger than I thought you were.
But because I don't think now that those boundaries help anyone, because you're absolutely right, because there are people who taught me at school and they always seemed ancient. You know, yeah, the way that they dressed, the demeanor, and you know, they were literally like the strict old spinster or something. Mm. You know, that was the image, that they were often single or presented as single, and they were, you know, they'd often wear their gowns, yeah, literally to school, you know, their graduation gowns, you know, because, you know, they were the teacher, and very much, you know, they were in charge, and all they did was teach. We knew nothing about their personal life, if ever they had one. That they didn't give any impression that they did. They literally, you know, but they never seemed to enjoy the job. They were always telling people off.
Yeah.
And yet that was all they did. Anyway, all these years later, you know, often through Facebook, you suddenly find out that some of these people, these teachers, are still alive. And you're thinking, but hang on, they must have been 70 then. You realise that they weren't. And the frightening thing, so I was at school in the 80s. And you work out that maybe they were only like barely 40. And I'm now 51. And you're thinking, there's no way they could have been younger than I am now when they taught me. And they're now maybe not, you know, around the same age as my parents, for example. And you look back and just think, that changes everything.
Yeah.
Because if I was to meet them now in you know, at the time that they were, and see somebody in their like 30s or 40s,
you'd be like, wow, you're so young.
But what do you do? What do you do? You can't, you know, you're too young to be, you know, living this very sort of sheltered life.
Yeah.
You know, do you not go out and party like Fran Morris did?
Yeah. And I think it's something that I tried to do being a lecturer. I also, my PhD supervisor, we became friends during my undergrad. And some people in my class would find that really weird. It was like, why have you gone for coffee with Andy Pomfret? It's like, well, this may surprise you, but he is actually a human being outside of the control lectures, and he's quite nice. and so I, you know, I had that kind of experience of breaking down that boundary, and having that realization of, because he was very much like that. He was like, I am a person. Obviously, you know, there is a boundary. You have to respect me. And if you ever, like, don't come to my lectures or slack off or, God forbid, get a bad grade in your exam, then, you know, I'm not going to be nice to you because we're friends, you know. Like, I will be serious in my capacity as your lecturer, but at the same time, we will have a laugh and everything. And I am a human being. So I tried to do that as well with my lectures. I would, you know, try and put memes in or like use colloquial language while I was teaching to make, because also some of my students were older than me in a foundation year or very close to age to me. They're only like, you know, 4 years or 6 years younger than me. So it's like, I'm not, you know, I also go on the internet the same way that you do. And I think another thing that is really important was, like, especially with this kind of teaching of doing examples live and everything, was I would make mistakes in front of them. And I think that that's a really important thing to do, to show that you are not perfect, and also to show that it's like, I am still learning stuff. You don't, education isn't that you do your degree and you suddenly, it's not like the Matrix where suddenly all this information is programmed into your body and then you're fine for the rest of your life. Like, you continually learn and you will forget things and you have to remind yourself of things as well. It's like, I got a first in this degree, but I'm still going to have to remember the chain rule because I haven't used it in 3 years or something like that. And like showing as well that you will make mistakes, and actually the skill is, well, where did I go wrong and how do I work through it, rather than like your expectation is that you will learn this information, you will be perfect at it for the rest of your life.
Yeah, because if you're doing a radio show and something goes wrong, I know often if you've got, there are two of you, then you can banter, you can, you know, there's the ways around it.
Yeah.
But if you're on your own, as I am, and I was, you know, sitting in a radio studio without anyone there, and you press a button and nothing happens, then, you know, there's a part of me that would think, oh no, this is awful, panic, panic. Another part of me thinks, ah, this is, you know, okay, what can I do? Well, I'll talk, but I'll be open with the listeners and say, how interesting, I'm pressing this button, it's not happening. And then you sort of make conversation around it. And when I listened back to that, I thought, actually, this is fine, but it's like normal conversation.
Yeah.
And actually, I sounded like I was completely in control, even though, you know, I was maybe worrying. And then it eventually did come on. And then I sort of, for the rest of the show, you're almost like incorporating that into the thing. At one point, there was an automated weather report. And at the time, I thought, oh, no, this is awful, because there's me doing the weather, starting the show, and then there's this other voice and it's all catastrophic. But it became the running joke for the programme, like, who's going to be reading the next weather forecast? Will it be me or the computer?
Yeah.
And actually, I wouldn't have, you know, if I'd done it pre-recorded, the programme, it would all have been smooth. But what a far less interesting programme it would have been.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's two things there. It's like the skill of learning to adapt in the moment is, whatever you're doing in life, is a hugely valuable skill. In radio, it is like that turned up to 100, because you're on air, potentially, you know, thousands of people listening to you. So yeah, it is, the pressure is high, and learning to adapt and being able to multitask as well at the same time, of talking and debugging a desk at the same time, is a skill. But yeah, the making the content around it as well is, it sometimes is great. I love Greg James on the Radio 1 Breakfast Show, and he's really good at it, of like, you can tell that he is so skilled and so experienced, because if something goes wrong, it doesn't throw him, and he will make a joke of it, he will have fun. You can tell he's totally in control at all times. Even if something hasn't happened, he can, you know, even if a button has gone wrong, he'll be like, who's done this, blah blah blah, and it makes it funny and it makes it human as well. It removes that veneer. I think we are moving into a slightly different radio world now, where it's not as polished as it used to be, of you know, this shiny presentation, that I think it's a little bit unlike this style where I'm struggling to verbalize it. I think it's more conversational now. It's more chatty. It's less performative. I think you've still got a bit of that, obviously, because there's the skill involved of making it sound really good. But it is, like you say, a conversation in a pub where, you know, if something goes wrong, people respond to it the way that they would, and you have that kind of, it's almost casual feel to it, which I think works really well.
But there's an analogy, I suppose, with a lecture as well, that when you were sitting in a lecture when you were a student, these days you probably don't remember every word of what the tutor was telling you, but you might remember the conversations around it. In other words, you remember, you get the feel, the mood of the day. So, you know, what did the lecture talk about? Can't remember, but I remember the impression that they exuded. In other words, then that there's the official thing, the official narrative, that the reason that they're there to present. But often, like, if something goes wrong on the radio show, then actually that makes, rather than diminishes the show, it makes the show better. But on paper, you'd think that's awful, you know. When something goes wrong, it's how you respond.
Yeah.
And that's just normal life. And what you need is that radio show or that lecture to be, in a way, a microcosm of that, rather than to be something that is like so perfect, it'll stand forever. But it's just nonsense.
It's not real life.
Because the lecture that I did, if I did a lecture 20 years ago and then recycled it now without any changes, it would just be out of date, and it would have weird cultural references.
Exactly. It needs to be kind of a mirror of real life.
Yeah. Well, as we start to wrap up, one thing I haven't asked you is about music, because obviously we're sitting here with KMFM, Kent's biggest hit sign right in front of me. And, you know, when you were growing up, Nubi, did music play a big part?
Yes, absolutely. My parents love music. So I've kind of definitely taken this from my dad of, I can't really not have music on at any one time. It has to be either the radio or Spotify on in the background. And if there's silence, it's unnerving. It's like there needs to be some kind of background noise. So my parents always had music on when we were younger. Another kind of thing about when you look back, I would always be like, oh, my parents listen to my parents' music and I listen to the cool hip stuff. But recently, I did some shows on Radio 1 when I first started doing radio. It was kind of like the springboard. And we used to present Radio 1 dance for an hour in the morning. We're doing early breakfast, did 10 shows over August, and 4 till 5 was Radio 1 dance. And all the music was songs that my parents would play when I was younger. And I was like listening to it going, my God, my parents had amazing music taste, and I never knew, because I was just like, oh, it's just a song so my parents listen to. Or like, oh yeah, my parents like this dance kind of wavy music. And I didn't realise, it was like, wow, my parents actually have incredible dance music taste. Like, it just kind of blew my mind a little bit and made me appreciate them a little bit more in the musical education that they gave me.
Yeah, because when I'm doing my show, because I know that they listen, and of course, if I'm playing something from, well, in my parents' case, it's like 50s or 60s, but I'm playing something, I've heard in Shapiro the other day, there we are, 1961, and that's my like parents' generation, and I'm playing music from their generation on my radio show, all these many, many decades afterwards. And that feels kind of nice. It feels like the circle has been squared. Like somehow, you know, there was this journey that I wanted to make, didn't quite make, but I'm making it now. But actually, it's not just a separate, like, it's like, you know, Chris is on the moon. What's he doing up there?
Yeah.
It's actually, not only is he on the radio, but he's playing music for us.
Yeah.
And it's the sort of stuff that we'd want to listen to.
Yeah.
I could never have imagined that in 1980-something.
Yeah, my parents obviously still love music. And one of the things that, like, a similar kind of moment of, oh, they're supporting my dream. They would, when I used to do the Hit List, which was a new music show, they would listen. And there was 2 years when my parents were in the States. So when I first started doing the show, they were in Boston. And my dad would have an alarm on his phone. It was like 4 p.m. for them in the afternoon. And he would tune in. Even though he was thousands of miles away, he would listen to my show. And every song that they liked that I played, they would add to a playlist called Modern Tunes. And they still have that playlist, and they add stuff to it and everything. So, you know, and then I'd come see them and they'd be like, oh my gosh, that Dua Lipa track, we love that. And they'd put it on and everything, or they'll start playing something and I'd be like, what? why are we listening to this song? It's like, oh, it's on Modern Tunes because you played it on KMFM. And it's just amazing that now, you know, they helped me discover so much music when I was younger, and now I'm helping them discover music.
That is beautiful. And it makes me think, I remember I was actually at this conference. Maybe I look back now and think, what was I even doing in this profession? I learned Greek and Latin for a summer, and I hated it. Because, I don't know why. I think it was more because I just got my degree. This was summer 94. And they had this conference on as part of this Greek and Latin classical. That wasn't even my degree, but anyway, I learned that for the summer. And this chap was there who'd given this talk, and he was wearing his sort of bow tie, and he was very sort of, you know, he looked like he belonged in the 19th century. and he was talking about how, you know, modern music was corrupting the soul, and, you know, the Beatles have destroyed Western civilization. and a younger lecturer said, well, hang on a minute. And he said, you know, and he was talking about Kurt Cobain and Nirvana. And of course, the chat was like, never heard of them. And I just thought, that says it all.
Yeah.
You think something's destroyed civilization, but really, you're talking about something from, you know, at that point, it was three decades earlier.
Yeah.
And there's no conversation to be had. You know, it was least, I might myself prefer to play music from the 70s or 80s, as I do. 80s is totally my era. But I wouldn't then not play stuff. Imagine if I suddenly said, Dua Lipa Hushi, no, I'm just going to play the Everly Brothers. You know, don't get me wrong, I'd love to play the Everly Brothers, but it would be a bit weird if that's all I played.
Yeah,
so in other words, there has to be this wider tapestry.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, even if you don't, you know, love that music and listen to it all the time, you should still kind of know what's going on if you're in this industry, even if it's not your flavour, to kind of see what's out there. Because you also, you know, a thing for us at KMFM, we play chart hits. And at the moment, what is very popular in the 2020s is pop, is dance, as a main genre. But if you think back into the early 2000s, or like the noughties, you had pop, but you also had a huge indie scene. You had a lot of bands, a lot of guitar-fronted music, and radio would have to balance those two flavours. And I remember when I started the hit list, my boss was like, we're currently playing pop and dance music because that's what's popular. But if that changes whilst you're on the hit list, you are going to have to become an expert in whatever becomes popular. Whether, you know, I really love pop music, so I'm having a great time now because all of the music that we play is stuff that I would listen to anyway. But, you know, if it suddenly rap became the main sound, I would have to get on board with rap because I can't not do,
Well, I was playing the other day Meghan Trainor and Mother.
Yes.
And it's brilliant, but it's also got the
Sandman.
Thank you. Because I listened to that and I thought, I really like this. And then I said, and then when I did the breakfast show last Friday, and I played the Cordettes in the original, so I know it was also used in Back to the Future, the Four Aces version. And I thought, how lovely, because suddenly now, at my age, I'm now playing something that today's audience will like, but then relating it to something from a different generation. And I thought, this is perfect.
Yeah.
You know, it's come full circle.
Yeah, exactly. I love that.
Yeah. Well, I got one more question for you, Mimi, she's looking, thinking, I always ask this question, and sometimes it wrong foot someone, but it's, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Ooh. That's a good question. I think I am a bit of both. I do love looking back. So there's an app that called Time Hop, where it accesses your, it's not as good anymore because Twitter, they changed all their API, so you can't use your tweets anymore, which was great because I used to look back at all the rubbish that I tweeted when I was like 18. But basically, it has access to your Twitter, your Instagram, any Facebook social media that you give it permission for. And every day it will be like, 4 years ago, you posted this, or 3 years ago, here's the photos that you took and in your library. And I look at that every day and I like to kind of reflect, I'm very nostalgic. I like to celebrate. You know, this year was 10 years from the first time that I did radio, and I did like a big post about it to celebrate that. And I like to kind of reflect on how far I've come, and or you know, the journey of things, or with my friends, it'll be like, oh my gosh, 6 years ago we met and now look at us, this is amazing. So I think it's really important to have that kind of reflection. But then I am ambitious. I've changed a little bit. I think when I was younger, I was very much like, I had the plan. I was like, I'm going to do these GCSEs, this A level, then I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to move to Japan and make robots. And then obviously I started doing my PhD and I was like, I don't think I want this anymore. So I don't have as strict a plan anymore because I've seen how much it can change. And I'm kind of in a period at the moment where I know roughly where, like, the North Star. I think it's important to have a slightly delusional dream. So my delusional dream is I would love to be a talk show host on TV. I would like to be the female Graham Norton. Putting it out there on a podcast so that there's recorded evidence. And, I would like to do that probably at 50 or 60. So I've given myself quite a lot of time to get there. I've got 40 years. 30 years. I'm 30. Oh, my gosh. Anyway, so that's kind of like my delusional North Star. So there are things that I know of what I could do and work on, and things that, eventually I will need to start doing some TV work because I don't have any experience in that if I want to get to that. But I don't have like this rigid ladder anymore of like, in 5 years' time I need to have done this, and in 7 years' time I need to have done this. It's kind of like I know the skills that I need to gain to work there, so I'm just gonna try and get there.
I think that's an amazing answer, but I just have to say that don't wait till you're 50 or 60. I can see you doing it now.
Oh, thank you.
and if anybody wants to see you on TV, because Walter Mitty came to mind, not that you're delusional, the opposite. But as we talked about that, as one of your favourite films, KMTV, Kent Film Club,
yes.
An episode with Numi that you can watch anytime.
Yeah, one of my only TV experiences. So. Oh.
Numi, wonderful to catch up with you again. Thank you ever so much for being my guest this week.
Thank you so much for having me.